It is Halloween Day here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox. Jeff Byers with you, and I believe we are joined. Man, it's been one thing after another. John Ziegler, kind enough to join us over the phone line, puts up with the postponement, puts up with the phone problem we're having getting out here from the studio. John, we appreciate your patience. Good morning. How are you?
Well, it's 6 a.m. here in Los Angeles.
I know it.
Good morning to you, Joe.
I really appreciate the time, as you know, forever appreciative of the work you've done in getting the truth out there in this Jerry Sandusky saga. This ongoing saga. I guess, John, let's just start with this most recent interview with, I guess it's not finalized, it's the soon-to-be, I guess, ex-wife of Ryan Rittmeyer, who, again, is alleged victim, well, I guess, legally is victim 10 in the Jerry Sandusky case in the trial. I finally was able to listen to the entire interview. She, I will say, comes across extremely well, extremely earnest in the way she came to the conclusion that she did, which, like pretty much everybody that actually sits down and takes a look at this case, is, oh, my God, Jerry Sandusky is actually completely innocent of the charges against him. I guess I want to start with, how did this interview, I know you go over it in the podcast, but for folks that haven't heard it, explain how this interview came about.
Well, that's actually an important part of this story, and people can listen to the whole thing for free without even any ads at our podcast, which is called With the Benefit of Hindsight, which is a 22-part epic podcast about the entire Penn State Joe Paterno Jerry Sandusky saga. And Jasmine is her name. Jasmine is the still currently wife of Ryan Rittmeyer, so-called victim number 10, who didn't just come to an opinion that her husband lied and that Jerry Sandusky was in fact innocent of all the allegations, not just his. But she was there, I mean, during literally the police interviews at the very beginning. She was the person who told Ryan that Jerry Sandusky had a person that she had no knowledge of at all, didn't even know how to pronounce his name, had been arrested back in November of 2011. This happened to have occurred the week before they got married, so she has a very, very strong recollection of all of this. And the reason why this interview came about is incredibly telling and very important part of the story on multiple levels. I have actually interviewed Ryan Rittmeyer earlier this year for about 2.5 hours. That interview has never been made public. The reason why that interview has never been made public, even though I have it and I would like to make it public, is that it was set up by, I guess, what I would call the Sandusky family investigator, Frank Parlato, a guy I know you're familiar with, I presume you've interviewed before,
yep,
who, in my opinion, has completely duped the Sandusky family into believing that he's somehow going to save this horrendous situation. I was very hopeful that Frank would be competent and reliable. I've come to conclude that he is both a lunatic and a fraud, and he has tried to facilitate Ryan Rittmeyer's a recantation of his trial testimony, and had done some things that were completely inappropriate, including having him live at his house in the Florida Keys for several months, promised him money in payment for his participation in a documentary. Bizarrely, Ryan ended up dating the daughter of Frank's close female companion. I mean, there's all sorts of very big problems here. And I had been informed of all this, and I said, well, let me interview Ryan and see where he's at, and maybe we can convince him that Jerry is actually innocent and that he can fully recant his testimony. And I did this interview, and it was extraordinary in many ways. Bizarrely, Frank was more protective of Ryan than he was of Jerry Sandusky, in my opinion, because Ryan, at that point, had still not 100% recanted his testimony. He recanted a lot of it. frankly, in my opinion, he made up a new story as a fig leaf, because I think he wants to remain in his mind psychologically some sort of a victim in this situation. But it was very clear after the 2.5-hour interview with Ryan that he was never abused by Jerry Sandusky, which did not surprise me at all. The interview completely exposed him, but Frank objected to me releasing the interview, and I didn't want to cause a problem with Jerry's appeal. So I did not have not yet released and don't have any imminent plans to release that interview, but we did a podcast episode about it, and Jasmine happened to research the Jerry Sandusky case, listened to the previous episode of the podcast, contacted me. We had a conversation. She told me that she had concluded from numerous sources, including Mark Pendergrass's book, The Most Hated Man in America, which concludes that Jerry Sandusky is innocent, that based upon her own experiences with Ryan, Ryan was clearly not a victim of Jerry Sandusky, and that now she is convinced that Jerry Sandusky is innocent. And so I said, well, do you want to do an interview? She said, not really. But I was able to convince her that, you know, this is a good idea for the purposes of justice. She went ahead and did it, and she did an extraordinary job. And I think anyone that cares about this case ought to listen to the whole thing. It ends very, very emotionally and very powerfully. And you can listen to it at, again, our website. Our website is framingpaterno.com, but the podcast is With the Benefit of Hindsight.
Yeah, I think it is fair to say that she is, strongly believes in Jerry Sandusky's innocence and feels horribly for the circumstance that he continues to face. I actually thought one of the more fascinating parts, though, for me, John, listening to the interview, was at the beginning of it, where one of the more telling things to me about why her story is to be believed, and really this goes to a lot of the accusers. Ryan Rittmeyer, I do believe, and I think she believes, and I'm assuming you believe, was in fact sexually abused in his childhood. It just wasn't by Jerry Sandusky. And I think that's the case. I mean, when you look at Aaron Fisher, I think several of the individuals, and my guess is somewhere in their mind, they're like, well, this at least gets me some vindication. I'm getting some sort of a payment for the abuse I suffered, even if the person that did the abuse isn't the person suffering. That's my takeaway from this. But Jasmine was told, I guess, by Ryan, it sounds like fairly early in their relationship, that that he was abused. But again, it wasn't Jerry Sandusky. His name never was mentioned, which is just bizarre if he's sharing his tales of sexual abuse, that he would never mention the Sandusky case, which then he testifies happened over and over and over again.
Jeff, you make a really important point that I don't think very many people have understood how significant it is to how the Sandusky saga, this fiasco, was allowed to happen. I 100% am convinced that Aaron Fisher, victim number one, was sexually abused by his stepfather, Eric Daniels, who actually did go to prison for child sex abuse. The media never told you this. And when I found that out, that was one of a critical moment for me in this entire case. When Eric Daniels pled guilty to 100 counts of child sex abuse, including against his own children, although not specifically against Aaron, the hair on my forearm stood up, because I'm like, oh my gosh, that's how this happened. And that's how Aaron was able to be a plausible sex abuse victim against Jerry Sandusky. Ryan has a very similar story. He had told his wife, Jasmine, about this episode involving an uncle when I believe he was 8 years old. Now, the nature of the abuse is a little bit vague to me, but he describes it as abuse, and he absolutely told Jasmine about it, but he never told her about Jerry Sandusky. And then when she tells him Jerry Sandusky was arrested, he says, that's impossible. I know Jerry Sandusky. Jerry Sandusky is a great guy. He would never do anything that to anybody. He says this as an adult. and then there's a series of machinations where investigators come to, and this is, of course, after Jerry's arrest, desperately come to talk to Ryan, and I think he gets cold feet, and he tells them a non-story where there is no actual abuse. Even Jasmine was very confused by it. And then a few weeks later, I think Ryan figures out that this is a money-making proposition and decides to become a victim of Jerry Sandusky. And I don't think it's just Aaron and Ryan. Part of the perfect storm for Jerry Sandusky in the situation was the Second Mile Charity. The Second Mile Charity, of course, was obviously a charity for at-risk kids, boys and girls. Well, let's face facts, especially in central Pennsylvania, when you have at-risk boys, you're going to have a lot of sexual abuse, a lot of abuse in a lot of ways. That's why they're at-risk kids.
Yeah.
And then when they're adults and their lives are a mess, and they're, you know, divorced or unemployed or doing drugs or whatever, all the problems that go along with a difficult at-risk childhood, they're going to be in a situation where they might look at the Jerry Sandusky circumstance and go, I see an opportunity here. And Ryan Rittmeyer, who had previously gone to prison, it's important to point that out. That's how pathetic the prosecution case was. That, you know, they expected that when Jerry got arrested, they were going to get this cascade of much better accusers than what they had at the time of his arrest. And all they got were numbers 9 and 10. And, you know, Ryan had gone to prison for theft, and Sebastian Payton, number 9, his mother has now completely recanted her testimony. She was the last prosecution witness at trial, and she's alleging a conspiracy with the prosecutors to profit from Sebastian Payton making $20 million from this case. But your point is incredibly important. I think it's exactly what happened here. It's a way that a lot of the accusers were able to rationalize what they did. Hey, you know, I wasn't abused by Sandusky. He looks to me like he must have been a pedophile, because the whole world's telling me he's a pedophile. So I'm not putting an innocent man in prison, and I'm getting paid for my prior sexual abuse. It just wasn't by Jerry Sandusky, and that's how they rationalized what they did here.
Well, and John, to me, a lot of these stories were basically fed by prosecutors. To your point there, it wasn't, and, you know, we made this point years ago on the show, but there's a difference in terms of the story being told. If I come to you and say, John, what happened when you were with Jerry Sandusky, and you say, all right, this is what happened, he abused me this way. That isn't what occurred. Almost to a person, initially, they're asked, what happened with you and Jerry Sandusky, and it was nothing. In a couple of cases, it was, well, he put his hand on my knee,
right.
And, you know, by all admissions, Jerry is a touchy-feely person. He's a caring
right.
individual, all of that. And then it is when the prosecutors say, well, we know he abused other boys. Are you sure he didn't do anything with you? And then, well, you keep leading, and it's like, well, in some of these other cases, this is what he did. Oh, well, my God, if he did that, I want to cooperate. I want to help put this person that behind bars. I don't want to let somebody free. And then so you start to think, I think even with Mike McQuarrie, again, the story of the grand jury presentment, which, John, I swear is still the story that the overwhelming majority of the general public, hey, what happened at Penn State? I don't really know. I know the assistant coach saw Sandusky anally raping a boy. Well, not at all what happened, but that's what gets put into the grand jury presentment. And to this day, I think most of America would be shocked to learn, one, that is the one case that he wasn't convicted on, Jerry Sandusky. Two, Mike McQuarrie is adamant that he never saw that. He heard slapping sounds. Very different than seeing anal penetration. I go right on down the line with each story. But the great frustration is the people that think they know what happened here, they just have the basic facts wrong.
Well, you said a lot there. Let me try to break it down. The first point about being manipulated by prosecutors, this is not just theoretical. There's a tape of this happening with victim number 4, who was so important to the prosecution that he usurped victim number 1, Aaron Fisher, as the first person to testify at Jerry Sandusky's trial. There is a tape of prosecutors inadvertently, because they thought that the recording was off, conspiring with the attorney of victim number four. By the way, why did victim number four even have an attorney and an interview to determine whether or not he was a victim of Jerry Sandusky? That doesn't make any sense at all. Yeah. But we have this on tape where the prosecutors are saying that they conspired is not in any way an exaggeration. They're basically saying to each other and to the lawyer, hey, can we lie to victim number four about what other evidence we have to convince him that he's not alone in this? And voila, they say to the lawyer, oh, yeah, sure, we do that all the time, no problem. So then, and this is all when they thought the recorder was off. This should have been a massive bombshell at trial, yet the media, because they thought they already knew the result of all this, didn't care. They go back to victim number four, and suddenly he, after trying to get him to become a victim, becomes a victim in a very horrific way that ends up being the number one testifier at Jerry Sandusky's trial. Now, so this is... And that's what we have on tape, Jeff. That's on tape. Yeah. So if you listen to Jasmine's interview, it's very clear the same thing happened to Ryan. As far as Mike McQuarrie is concerned, the first episode of our podcast with the benefit of hindsight, as I think you know, is called The Date. And to me, this is my biggest mistake in the entire case because I was late in figuring this all out. We know for sure that Mike McQuarrie got the date, the month, and the year of that episode catastrophically wrong once. I am convinced he got it catastrophically wrong twice in a way that proves that he did not go see Joe Paterno the next morning. He waited 6 weeks to go see Joe Paterno. That is not remotely consistent with anything that was in the grand jury presentment. And we still don't even have Mike McQuarrie's grand jury testimony because, I'm quite certain it would not be good for the prosecution. Mike McQuarrie did not see a sexual assault, and anybody who has looked at that situation objectively knows that to be 1,000% the case.
Yes, and the other part of that, John, is, again, I think Mike was genuinely trying to be helpful, and I think that I don't even know if initially the prosecution maybe I'm giving them too much of the benefit of the doubt, but I think that they honestly thought that they had somebody who was a sexual predator. One of the things, just looking back on the entire case, John, that I also think, in retrospect, everybody jumped to the conclusion that, well, that kind of shows he's guilty. I actually think just the opposite, again, with the benefit of hindsight, is that interview that Sandusky gave with Joe Amendola present, his lawyer, to Bob Costas. And again, I'm listening to that at the time, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is horrific. And then you think back, and it's like, well, what the prosecution, though, is telling you is that Jerry Sandusky was this master manipulator, and for all of these years he fooled people, and he knew how to work the individuals and get them to trust him, and then, boy, he was a smooth talker, and he knew how to do this and that, and hey, he got them over, and he got the children close to him, and he got the parents' trust, and he knows how to pull it off. And then in the biggest moment of his life, he forgets how to manipulate. In the biggest moment of his life, he comes across as somebody that is clueless on how to handle a big-time interview. Like, it makes no sense in retrospect.
Well, in my defense, that was my reaction at the time.
I was mine as well, and I know Jerry. I mean, I've known him since I was a kid.
No, but what I mean by, and I didn't know Jerry at all at that time, my reaction was kind of what you just said. I had presumed that Jerry was guilty until the Costas interview. But to me, the Costas interview was so bad, I'm like, wait a minute. We have to understand that what we're being told here is that obviously this was going on for 40-some years. If Jerry Sandusky was really doing this, he could not have possibly been this bad at answering simple questions like, are you sexually attracted to young boys? And also, by the way, if this was all true, he would be thinking every single day about why he's sexually attracted to young boys. This would be a huge part of of his persona. Yeah. He would not be thinking about it, you know, for several seconds before finally answering. And by the way, it is important to point out that prior to that, Costas asked him whether or not he was guilty. He said no, definitively.
Right.
And also, as you well know, Jerry Sandusky tends to hesitate on almost anything you ask him. You ask him what time of day it is, he might respond in a very similar way. But, you know, I wasn't convinced Jerry was innocent based upon the Costas interview, but I did start to think, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense at all based upon the narrative we're being told. And by the way, I should point out that Bob Costas has done another interview with the Benefit of Hindsight podcast earlier this year, episode number 20. I'm in constant contact with Bob Costas to this day, which is extraordinary. I mean, since he is the person that is most associated with Jerry Sandusky's guilt in the minds of the vast majority of the public and even some of the media, Bob is very open-minded about this. I don't want to speak for what Bob's true opinions are, but you can listen to episode 20 and an extraordinary exchange where for the first time, and I've been hoping for this for many, many years, Bob starts to ask me questions about the case, and it's clear that Bob's eyes are open, and I think, you know, again, people can conclude for themselves, but I'm very confident, I've said this publicly previously, that if Bob Costas himself had been on Jerry Sandusky's jury, based upon what Bob Costas currently knows, he would never have voted to convict beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, I wonder, John, how many of the jurors that were on that case, knowing what is now out there, I don't know how many of them are following all of your work and Frank's and everything going on in the case. I do wonder how many of them now would at least have serious questions and would change that verdict.
I doubt that any of them are following it because, you know, the mainstream news media has a complete lockdown on this case. They've been told that this is, you know, a fait accompli. There's no question about this. Penn State, of course, has gone along with this narrative in every possible way. I mean, we can't even get, you know, the football field named for Joe Paterno, for goodness sakes. Can't get the statue back. No one even knows where the statue is. I mean, Penn State's involvement in this is paramount. Penn State is perceived as pleading guilty to everything, not just for Sandusky, but essentially for Paterno and for the administrators. Yeah. And in the public's mind, that's game, set, match. The public cannot understand that Penn State had a perverse, upside-down self-interest here. The people at Penn State, especially after they panicked and fired Joe Paterno in one of the dumbest decisions ever made in the history of academia, which is really saying something, after that happened, they were all invested in not having screwed up. And that's why the free report came down the way that it did. It was paid for by Penn State, giving Penn State exactly what they wanted. The public can't understand that. Even the media can't understand that. But Penn State's incentive structure is upside down in this case. They have an incentive to be seen as guilty, because if they weren't guilty, they threw all their best people under the bus in the middle of a moral panic when they were innocent, and they gave away hundreds of millions of dollars in money that nobody deserved. So to me it's very simple, but to me, most people cannot understand Penn State's involvement on this. And once you do understand Penn State and their perverse self-interest, everything else starts to really come to peace. All the pieces of this puzzle come into place.
I want to pick up on that. Can you stay with us for one more segment, John?
Sure.
All right, we're going to take a break. I want to pick up on that because when you look at the people that were prosecuted, not just Jerry Sandusky, and although Paterno wasn't legally prosecuted, certainly publicly he was at least persecuted. What is amazing when you look at Tim Curley, Graham Spanier, Gary Schultz, all of the individuals, the people closest to them, stuck by them. They still stick by them. They're like, no, we know these are good, honorable, decent people. Then you look at the prosecution, you look at the victims, and you see quite a different setup. I want to delve a little bit into that and that angle of this case as we continue. You are listening to Let's Talk on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7
The Fox.
Kevin Harlan. Carlin here from Monday Night Football on Westwood One. Join us all season long for primetime action on the road to the playoffs and Super Bowl 60. Each week, Hall of Fame quarterback Kurt Warner and I will have the call of great matchups, along with Mike Golic, senior and junior, in the studio. Don't miss out on the great NFL tradition that is Monday Night Football.
Catch all the action all season long. Sports Radio 98.7, The Fox. Looking for something different? But you want something that's quick and affordable that won't set you back in the pocketbook? Then you need to head down to Brothers Pizza and Courthouse Pub, right next to the Center County Courthouse on North Allegheny Street in downtown Belfast. They feature only the best pizza in town and also the finest selections from Robin Hood Brewing Company, University Wines, and Big Spring Liquors. Come celebrate happy hour in Happy Valley every Tuesday through Saturday from 4 to 6 at Brothers Pizza and Courthouse Pub in downtown Belfast.
Eating healthy is important for us and for our animals. The Center Hall Farm Store knows this. Local, fresh ingredients are put in all of our feeds. Expert care from people ingrained in our community. If you haven't been to the Center Hall Farm Store yet, do yourself and your animals a favor and stop on in at 110 Allison Street in Center Hall. See what a difference the local touch can make in providing real quality. And be sure to check out our website at centerhallfarmstore.com.
Getting ready for tailgating or weekend? You need to stock up at the 64 Beer Store near Lamar. The 64 Beer Store has the coolest beer in the county. Over 400 selections, including IPAs, ciders, Oktoberfest beers, cocktails, and wines. The 64 Beer Store carries ready-to-drink cocktails. Conveniently located near Lamar on Nittany Valley Drive, just a half mile north from I-80 on Route 64. On the way from here to there. Stop in today.
This is Jim Galante from the Keystone Sports Network. For the best Penn State football analysis and commentary, join me, Dustin Hawkinsmith, T. Frank Carr, Andy Shea, and Jeff Byers every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox and State College. We'll bring you game reviews, player evaluation, recruiting news, and plenty more on the Nittany Lions. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Fox Sports 98.7 for the Keystone Kickoff Show.
It is our Halloween edition of Let's Talk. Again, Scott Giese off this week. He will be back on Monday. And we are joined by John Ziegler, and thrilled to have him on with the Benefit of Hindsight podcast, is where you will find his truly remarkable work on this case. Before I get into kind of everything being flipped backwards in this case, John, there was one thing that just it has really bothered me more than it should, and I'm usually pretty good at letting online comments go, but I did see somebody responded to your post with this interview, and they're like, give me a break, Sandusky's guilty, there was a preponderance of physical evidence in the case. And you did respond, actually there was no physical evidence, which is one of the reasons those of us that believe he's innocent have a great deal of trouble with the way this thing was handled. But I do think that's a significant point to make, is to this date there has been no physical evidence, none, with all of these victims out there and all of these different cases. Nobody could produce a text, anything showing that, yeah, something happened, or Sandusky showed guilt or remorse over an action. And it just, that is not the way these cases work. You look at every other pedophile case that's out there, and then same thing when you look at, the family, the people close to Sandusky, and then I do want to get into the prosecutors in the case there. But let's just start with the physical evidence, John. To this date, there has been no physical evidence produced against Jerry Sandusky.
Well, your point is extremely well taken, but you missed, I think, the most significant element of this. No pornography. That is
none.
Completely impossible. Impossible. I have never found, and I've been looking now, because I've been on this case for 14 years, I have never found a serial pedophile case in the modern history of America where there was not one shred of pornography that was ever found anywhere. In fact, the only pornography in this entire case, and this is not an exaggeration, was found in emails between judges and prosecutors and investigators. And nothing involving Jerry Sandusky. That is, I defy anyone to find another case like that. It's just not possible. And it's ironically one of the greatest problems with Jerry Sandusky's appeal. The first problem is that he's afraid to go into federal court, because if you go into federal court and you lose, you have nothing else to do the rest of your life. You're going to die in prison. He naively keeps thinking he's going to get a fair deal in Pennsylvania, which is impossible. But when you appeal a criminal conviction, generally you go after the physical evidence that was used against you. But there is no physical evidence. So I've described trying to appeal this case like shooting ghosts, since this is Halloween. You're trying to shoot ghosts here. There's nothing but testimony that was ever changing and not credible from people who got paid millions and millions of dollars. It's almost impossible. Now, there are very good bases for appeals, like the Brady violations of the prosecution, but this is part of the perfect storm here, and it can never be forgotten. It can never be forgotten. There was no pornography in this case involving Jerry Sandusky.
Which, as you said, is truly extraordinary in a case like this. It just, that is not what pedophiles do with their off time. And I've had some people, well, he didn't have to because of...
Oh, my God. Yeah, okay. That is the most... That, to me, is an indication where people just, for some reason, want to believe this dark fairy tale. And that is maybe the most mysterious part, psychologically, of this entire situation for me, that I have been stunned by just how much the general public wants to believe this story was true. And I think it's mostly because of the Joe Paterno angle. I think that because Joe Paterno was taken off of his pedestal, people were able to think of themselves as being better than the great Joe Paterno, because at least they never enabled a serial pedophile to get away with their crimes in order to protect the football program. I mean, I really think that's the only logical explanation I can come up with, because people, you would think that people would be saying to me and others who are in agreement with me, fantastic, this didn't really happen. That's great news. But very, very, very few people are in that category.
As you say, everything about this case just seems upside down. To that end, John, I do want to get in a little bit. When you look at the severe lapses in judgment, I'm trying to be kind, to the prosecutors, and some of the problems they have when it comes to ethics, and then you look... And even those close to the prosecutors are like, maybe we'll take a step back. To this day, is extremely telling. Now, it may not be legally relevant, but to me it is very relevant in terms of trying to determine where the truth tellers are in this case. Those that are closest to Jerry Sandusky, his wife, his family, when you look at most cases, the overwhelming majority of cases where you have child predators, those closest to them start to piece stuff together like, oh my God, yep. And you get divorces, you get, I don't want to have anything to do with them. This is exactly the opposite here. Well, no, we know this didn't happen. And again, I know not legally relevant. I'm just telling you, I know Dottie Sandusky.
Right.
There is a 0% chance that she is standing by somebody that she even thinks for a moment might have one time, maybe, possibly, abused a child. Like, that is not who she is. Not possible.
Right. Well, Jeff, you've hit on one of my favorite ways to describe this case. I'm not even 100% sure you're fully aware of how much I've used this logical device to try to convince people. Forget about all the facts of the actual case. Let's just look at what has happened since the criminal trial. And I'm a big believer that you learn a lot after a criminal trial or after an election or after somebody gets fired. You know, the truth eventually comes out, right, if you pay attention long enough. So let's do a little exercise here real quick. So, as you've already referenced, Dottie Sandusky not only has not divorced Jerry Sandusky, she still lives in State College, right? Which is insane, right?
Yeah. In the same house that they lived in at the time he was prosecuted.
Right, which is it's impossible for someone who, if they had any belief that they were part of the guilt of their husband, they would move, if only for make their lives easier. But she has zero guilt, zero consciousness of guilt, and is 100% supportive of her husband. But that's just the beginning. Other than Matt Sandusky, who we've completely discredited 1,000 times over, and everyone in this family knows he's is lying sack of crap, the rest of the family, as you know, is extremely supportive of Jerry. But it's not just Jerry. I mean, obviously, Graham Spanier, Tim Curley, and Gary Schultz,
yep.
No divorces there. How is that possible? How are none of them divorced? By the way, how is it that my wife hasn't left me? I'm sure she asks herself that question every single day. I mean, so there's been no divorces on the so-called defense side of this situation. On the other side, Aaron Fisher, victim number one, is divorced. His mom is divorced. Mike McQuarrie is divorced. Ryan Rittmeyer is in the process of divorce. Frank Fina, the prosecutor in the case, lost his law license. The grand jury judge lost his position because of his involvement in this case. Aaron Fisher's therapist lost his state certification because of his involvement in this case. I mean, it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Why is it? How is that possible? How is it possible that if what we were told was remotely true, that nobody, you know, Jerry's not divorced, Graham's not divorced, Tim's not divorced, Gary's not divorced, Ziegler's not divorced, and yet everything on the other side of this equation is exactly upside down? It doesn't make any damn sense unless what we're saying is true and the narrative we were given was a dark fairy tale.
Yeah, and even above and beyond that, John, it is the when you look at the both legal and just again ethical issues that have come up on the prosecution side versus again outside of this Sandusky case. Can you find anybody saying anything bad about Tim Curley, Graham Spanier, in terms of the way they conducted their personal or professional lives? Gary Schultz, even Jerry Sandusky. I mean, I know most hated man in America, but like outside of this, everybody agrees. Well, no, I and I get this is an awful thing to be convicted of, but really, he had no other shortcomings in his entire life that anybody wants to pile on with. Like, I do find that truly remarkable.
Well, you've hit on yet another important element of this whole story, and how it is that Joe Paterno, Graham Spanier, Tim Curley, Gary Schultz, and Jerry Sandusky, who all lived exemplary lives, never got one shred of benefit of the doubt, even in the first few days of this story. I mean, not a shred of the benefit of the doubt. Look what's happening with Chauncey Billups and this NBA scandal situation. I mean, I don't want to confuse the issues, but there's no media hysteria surrounding that. We're just going to wait and find out what the facts are, wait for a trial. Well, no one wanted to wait in this case.
Yeah.
We reacted first, and then we found out the facts later. And it is extraordinary that, you know, these five men who had exemplary records, and I believe were very good men, were thrown under the bus by Penn State and by most of the state college community in a media panic, in a moral panic, in a total frenzy. By the way, on my previous point about let's look what's happened since, I completely forgot one of the most important elements. Sarah Ganim, the local reporter who got credit for breaking this whole case. She was the one that broke the grand jury report well before this story exploded nationally in 2011. She gets the Pulitzer Prize. She wins the Pulitzer Prize, right? Let's just take a real quick look at what's happened since. She wins the Pulitzer Prize for her role in this story, which is her role was incredibly important,
yep.
Not just from a media perspective, but from a prosecutorial standpoint. She is now currently, and she never writes a book about this case. which is impossible. It's almost like there being no pornography. It's impossible to win a Pulitzer Prize and never write a book. You're a writer. You're a print reporter. You win a Pulitzer Prize, you never write a book about this case. You can't write a book about this case because she would either reveal the farce of the case or she would have nothing to write about because she was handed a story in a way that, to manipulate her as a 23-year-old cub reporter. But not only did she not write a book, she gets its plum gig at CNN, where she has infinite resources. Back when CNN was still considered very credible, she does nothing. Nothing. She gets, and her contract is not renewed, and now she's out of the business. How is that possible? If Sarah Gannon was this journalistic savant that we were told she was back in 2011, how could she never write a book and be out of the business already? That's just not possible.
No, I actually think that's a great point, because as we've been saying on this show, that she was just, as you said, she was a young cub reporter, and she's being fed this amazing story by the prosecutors, and that's what she did. She fed the prosecutor's story pretty much word for word, and yeah, got all kinds of accolades for it, but never really delve into the the other side of the case. And
now she actually recruited victims for the prosecution. That was actually put into evidence in court. The prosecution had to stipulate that was real, and the media just ignored it, and she still won the Pulitzer Prize.
Truly astounding. I mean, just beyond belief. John, I want to go back to Jasmine's interview and just the combined with Rittmeyer. I don't know. I guess you would say he recanted, what, 90-95% of the story he had told originally about Sandusky?
Based upon my interview with him, and, I actually think, unfortunately, that the appeal that Jerry just filed is based partly in false information, because I don't believe that Ryan has completely recanted his testimony. Now, maybe since Jasmine's interview came out, that was part of what my thinking was, that this might convince Ryan to give up the ghost and to finally tell the full truth. But it's difficult to describe Ryan's recantation, because he says that the prosecutors manipulated him into saying things that weren't true. He said that his lawyers told Penn State things that were not true. He recants most of what he said in his trial testimony, but then he makes up this what I perceive to be news story of being abused in Jerry Sandusky's basement which he never mentions at trial. So it's kind of hard for me to describe, okay, what's the status of his recantation? You'll have to ask his buddy Frank Perlato for the latest on that. But unfortunately, I think Frank has contaminated whatever legal value that Ryan's recantation may have for the reasons I've already given.
John, one of the problems I also think, because I keep thinking and holding out hope that there will be multiple alleged victims that will come forward and own up, but between you and Frank and I guess we can now say Chad, I guess he's okay with his name being used publicly.
I presume so at this point.
And Chad Dubin was had gone and was seeking out the individuals trying to get them to basically own up to the truth, just to get them to tell the real story. But my takeaway from all of you is that most of these, if not all of these victims, that their lives are in such shambles that I'm not sure, like Alan Myers, I mean, it's actually a sad tale, but I mean, I don't know that Alan, even if he recanted it in the state that he's in right now, I'm not sure how credible anybody would take him at this point.
Well, you're referring to Alan Myers, who was the so-called boy in the shower in the Mike McQuarrie episode, who never testified at Jerry Sandusky's trial and publicly and privately given statements completely exonerating Jerry Sandusky. I am unaware of most of what's going on with him, other than I knew that he was in a wheelchair recently. But I don't know the status of his life. I know that Aaron Fisher's life is in complete disarray, and he's not just divorced. He's had numerous run-ins with the law. It appears as if he is into drugs in a significant way. It would not surprise me at all if that ends very, very tragically with Aaron Fisher, and my guess is that would be perceived as all being blamed on Jerry Sandusky, which of course is upside down world stuff. But the reality is that other than number nine Sebastian Payton, who got paid $20 million from Penn State, more than twice as much as anybody else for reasons that I think are very, very suspicious, especially given what we now know from Jerry Sandusky's latest appeal, it appears as if the accusers are out of money. They're no longer getting money. Most of them have blown that money. In fact, Ryan refers to himself in my interview as a lottery winner, and that he was actually proud that he did not lose his money as fast as most lottery winners do, which is quite an extraordinary and I think very, very telling statement. You would think that once the money runs out, that that would give more of an opportunity for them to come forward and tell the truth.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest problem, Jeff, is I don't know that most of them are aware that Jerry is actually innocent. See, that was part of why Frank Perlotto, when we were still working together, and I just tried to do this interview with Ryan. Part of the interview was to get him on the record. Part of it was to convince him that Jerry is actually innocent. That was the glue that held the prosecution case together, was this belief that Jerry must be guilty. And so, therefore, I'm not putting an innocent man in prison.
Right.
That's why a lot of these guys went along with this, especially once they realized there were millions of dollars at stake. And there's, the evidence of that is overwhelming, in my opinion. This happened on multiple occasions where guys who they realized, okay, I wasn't abused by Jerry, but he's guilty, and you know, so and I deserve this. And what's the real harm here?
Right.
And I'm actually helping put a monster pedophile behind bars. And so that's the biggest problem. Is it's really a catch 22. I mean, if the media ever did their job, and exposed that there is a completely different side of this story, and the people around these accusers put a little bit of pressure on them. And by the way, that's another part of the perfect storm here. Most of these accusers are still anonymous in their own worlds because the media never used their names, even though they were adult males. And so the people around them, many of them don't know that they got their money from being a Jerry Sandusky accuser. So there's not even people in their world that say, wait a minute, you were abused by Jerry Sandusky? You never said anything bad about him. You only said great things about him. There's never been any pressure put on these people in that regard. Now, I've tried my best to do so.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there's some accusers that are aware that there's a completely different side of this case. Weirdly, I've always thought that Matt Sandusky had the greatest incentive to reverse himself. One, because he got the least amount of money, and two, the gravy train is over for him. And three, as you well know, Dottie still holds out hope that he'll come home and that she'll get access to the grandkids again. I actually believe that Matt, bizarrely, would be treated like a prodigal son if he ever recanted his testimony.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence that that's going to happen because Matt has no soul.
He's had problems from day one. That's another story for probably another show. John, we thank you. The truth is available, folks. I don't know how we get it into the court system. I'm hopeful that this appeal will go the way all of the appeals previously should go, but I'm not overly optimistic. I will say that.
Well, Pennsylvania is never going to give Jerry Sandusky justice when the judges are up for election. It's just that simple.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen.
No,
and that's why Jerry Sandusky has to go to federal court. And unfortunately, I thought I convinced him of that many years ago, but I failed. And until this gets into federal court, I'm not really remotely optimistic.
John, as always, appreciate the time, appreciate the work.
Thanks, Jeff.
John Ziegler, kind enough to join us this morning.